From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2008 in the maelstrom of the financial crisis on Wall Street. President George W. Bush worked with President-elect Barack Obama to thread a kind of needle. They decided that banks needed to be bailed out to protect the wider public, but they also agreed that those responsible for the mess would go to jail. And as you know, dozens of Wall Street executives were handcuffed, perp-walked across the street, just as authorities like to parade drug offenders for news cameras. And leading political figures in both major parties promised that people would not lose their houses. Just kidding, of course. No one went to jail. The banks got bailed out. Eventually, a whole lot of people lost their homes. And looking at the fires burning around him, a banker named Chris Arnotti was not feeling all that good about his work. So eventually, he left. And by now, you might know him as a writer and photographer who's taken up an entirely different line of work than he enjoyed on Wall Street. Arnotti travels the country, spending long hours in the most impoverished communities, towns where factories are closed, most of the jobs are gone, streets where drugs are the main economy, and an escape for those who feel forgotten or left out. He takes many pictures, and while he writes for publications like The Guardian, he uses Twitter to post his experiences and conversations. Chris Arnotti knew months before most others that Donald Trump was going to have staying power. His consistent message, Arnotti's, is that no one is better than anyone else, but too often in this country we mock those who are different, and that has created a massive divide in power, in culture, and yes, in voting. I heard last week that Chris Arnotti was heading back to Buffalo, and I asked him to stop in Rochester, and he's kind enough to do that. We saved a front row seat for you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here, and we're going to explain the joke about front row coming up here, but I just want to go back a little bit here. Did you get into banking right out of school?
I out of a PhD program. I got a PhD in physics at Johns Hopkins, and right out of 21st grade,
called it. And did I read correctly? You were with Citi? You were Citibank when the crash hit?
That's correct. I joined Solomon Brothers in 1993. They're famous for liars. That's where Liar's Poker was set.
Yes.
I was a bond trader, like the characters in Liar's Poker, I stayed in that seat, and then eventually we became Citibank, yes.
Okay, and what happened with Citi in 2008 or so?
We lost a lot of money. We lost, I don't know what the official number is, $70 billion, $80 billion. Had the government not been there, we would have gone bankrupt. But we didn't go bankrupt. We got bailed out.
You have said in other interviews that a lot of the reasons that Citi lost that much money was kind of fooling around with exotic financial products related to housing, subprime, those kind of things. Were you aware when you were at Citi that your colleagues were doing that?
Yeah, but I was always skeptical of I grew more and more skeptical of finance as I spent more time there. By 2006, I was pretty sure it was all going to blow up, but 2004, I thought it was going to blow up.
You did.
So I got it early. Yeah, but I didn't think it was going to blow up that big. And by 2000,
the housing specifically?
That the whole house of cards was going to fall. It was kind of a runaway train, but there were a lot of people like me who kind of bet early or thought early that it was going to happen. It was too early, and by 2007, I'd given up on that idea. I just figured that it was going to keep on going and going. I had no idea that it would become that big of a crisis. I mean, I knew we were creating a bit of a mess. I just the scope of the mess, I had no idea about.
Matthew Stoller is a former Senate budget analyst who's done a lot of interesting writing in recent weeks and months, and he has said that Donald Trump is a result of the Wall Street bailouts. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I agree. I would take a little bit step further back and say, but yeah, I agree with that. But would say that the Wall Street crisis was a reason. What didn't happen out of the blue. I mean, it was a result of 25 years of policy that kind of favored the capital and didn't care about labor. The crisis was just the most extreme example of that imbalance coming to fruition. But in terms of the idea that when they messed up, when we messed up, I put myself in there, that we got bailed out, that complete lack of fairness certainly set the groundwork for what we see now.
And so you were...
I jokingly say it was the anvil that broke the camel's back.
But were you looking around saying, well, thank goodness they bailed us out, or did it feel wrong to you?
On a personal basis, I was happy. I mean, I was really facing, like a lot of people, I was facing everything I had I had worked to, or every way I valued myself collapsing. So on a very personal basis, I mean, I had, you know, three kids, and I still have three kids. So they didn't go away with the crisis, but I had kids in private school, and I was, you know, I had a pretty expensive life, and I was living the Wall Street banker life. And so on a very personal basis, sure, it felt good to be bailed out. It felt wrong. And I think, you know, I certainly, if you had talked to me 5 years before the bailout, I was kind of all those things I talk about now in a somewhat negative way, of the people who kind of expect what they, you know, think what they're doing is kind of this life that's very valuable, when in fact I don't believe it is. So I would have defended everything that happened, and I would have said to you, well, what I was doing wasn't good, but it wasn't bad either. When the crisis happened, that's when I realized, okay, maybe what I'm doing is bad. And I thought that sort of epiphany, or that idea that here, you know, the front row kids, what I call the people who had kind of gone to all the right schools, got PhDs, got elite educations, and had built this world, I thought, you know, that kind of collapse, that our hubris would take a hit, that we would say, oh, no, we messed up.
You'd be chastened.
Yeah, chastened. And I expected to see, you know, I certainly went from saying, hey, what I was doing was benign, to what I was doing was wrong. And I expected others to have that. But in fact, the opposite happened. Most people around me, and there were exceptions, but the most people around me looked at me and said, no, actually, it wasn't our fault at all. If we had had only less regulation, or if we hadn't lent to poor people, you know, all those things that I kind of just was shocked. And that kind of disconnect between what I, you know, for me, it was humiliating, and I felt like we all needed to humble ourselves a little bit. And to actually see the opposite happening was very frustrating.
A sense of entitlement?
Certainly entitlement, but it goes deeper than that. It was, we always knew we were entitled, but I guess what I'd say was, after the crisis, became aware that I thought people knew they were entitled, but after the crisis, it became realized that people didn't realize they were entitled. They were so entitled that they didn't know they were entitled.
Sure. It's like the Dunning-Kruger of entitlement.
Exactly.
And so when did you leave? When did you make that decision?
Around 2012. I had started detaching myself from work. I was putting more and more of my energies into what I'm doing now. I would take these long walks. I called them terminus walks, on the weekends, and those, you know, where I'd 20-mile walks through New York City, where I just sit around and talk to people, and in neighborhoods that people would tell me not to go. I called them terminus walks, because I take the subway to the end of the line and walk home, you know, the terminus. And I started paying less attention to work. And, you know, I had done good well at work, so even though I was slacking off, they kept me. And then eventually I found myself 4 years later spending all my time, all my free time, and then taking days off work, a lot of time, days off work, to spend time documenting addiction and prostitution and poverty in the Bronx. Which is the Hunts Point neighborhood of the Bronx, which is the poorest neighborhood in the Bronx, poorest neighborhood in New York City, actually. And there was this weird disconnect where at night and on weekends, I was spending my time in crack houses talking to people who became my friends eventually. Then I'd go on during the day to Wall Street and work, and it was just like something had to give. The two lives were just not couldn't work together. And eventually, I left Wall Street.
Did you have friends or family say who understood what you were doing, and did they appeal to you that number one, it's not safe; number two, what the hell are you doing? You know, you've got this Wall Street life. Why are you so interested in drug houses and the most impoverished neighborhoods in the Bronx?
By that point, I was in my 18th year on Wall Street. So the people I had surrounded myself were good people. You know, I had made a choice of working with people who I respected.
So civil they got values?
Me. Yeah, they got me.
Okay.
My wife got me. But yeah, there was a, you know, the one where they didn't get was the safety. And it's something that I think people misunderstand is, you know, high crime neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods are really not that bad. It's just how you approach them. You know, if you approach them with the right attitude. I mean, I would walk into a crack house at 1 a.m. With a $5,000 camera, and no one's ever tried to take anything from me.
So what is the approach then?
I spend a lot of time, come back, come back, come back, and just prove, you know, people read you on the streets pretty quickly. If you have good intentions, they'll figure it out because they have to have that skill. They have to have the skill of knowing, you know, it's a survival skill.
Can I trust you?
Yeah, can I trust you? And, you know, maybe I'm naive, but I have always believed that if you fully trust somebody else, I've always said that if not trusting someone is at some level insulting. And in many cases, it can be just what I call personal racial profiling. If you don't trust somebody just because they're black or they're Hispanic or they're poor, that's insulting. So I do my best to, and I really do trust people. And, you know, at this point now, it's been 5 years of spending time in lower income neighborhoods and neighborhoods that people say don't go to. And I've never had a problem. Everybody to a person has treated me decently.
Talking to Chris Arnotti, who is telling us about his work across this country. You're hearing how it started when he left his work in Wall Street, started really working through the Bronx, but it's become a nationwide project. Maybe you've read some of his work in The Guardian, among other places, or follow him on Twitter, where he really uses that to show you photographs, to introduce you to people, and the kind of people who might feel like their stories never get told. And you know, Chris's work has been a little controversial. There are some who think he's a social anthropologist, the likes of which we really don't have in this country. And others are, you know, have found criticism, and we'll get to some of that coming up here. But I want to let you know, if you want to call the program and ask a question about what he has seen across the country or weigh in on any of this, you can call toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I want to define a term that you use often. You write about so-called front row kids and back row kids. A recent profile of your work, I think they published today in, how do you pronounce it, Aletia, Aletia?
I'm not sure of the pronunciation.
A-L-E-T-I-A.
It's a Catholic magazine.
Yeah, it has a nice profile of Chris and his work today. And they took the time to highlight some of what Chris has written about what it means to be front row and back row. I'd like to quote essentially what they pulled. So I'll give them the credit, but if you don't mind, I'm going to go ahead and quote, and
yeah,
you
yeah,
can
go
expand
ahead.
It. So this is what Chris writes about front row and back row. Quote, "The front row kids and minorities overwhelmingly support Hillary Clinton. A large percentage of everyone else supports Trump. The front row kids can't understand why anyone would support Trump, often saying anyone who does is just dumb. The front row kids who live in big cities and university towns primarily find meaning through their careers and hence through their education. It defines who they are. Their community and their neighborhoods are global. They moved towns often for their careers. The back row primarily finds meaning through their local community and its institutions like church and sports. They live in places they have long lived in and their families have lived in. They didn't leave for education, didn't leave for jobs. The front row kids have won really big. They now control the economic, social, political, and cultural agenda. They set the rules for everyone and have made some big changes. The front row has pushed through policies that have destroyed local communities, which is the primary source of value to the back row. Those policies, like NAFTA, work for the front row based on their concept of meaning. It has made many very rich. For the back row kids, it has destroyed a lot of their communities, hollowed them out of jobs and institutions, replaced local stores with global ones, redefined the nature of their work, entirely changed their lives without a clear benefit," end quote. I think that's a pretty good explanation for what front row and back row means. What's the shorter version for you?
Front row is people who have elite educations, people who define themselves through their educations. It's my past life. It's
you're a front row kid.
Yeah, it's probably a lot of people who are listening to this show. Back row is people who didn't necessarily go beyond high school, and if they did, it was a combination of community colleges and state schools. But I think it captures a little bit of the urban rural. There's some of that there, but I think it's deeper than that. And a lot of minority communities are in the back row, even though they did vote for Trump, and we'll get to that, the racial angle. But one of the things that struck me, and I at this point I put like 200,000 miles on my car driving around the United States, 100,000 in the last year and a half alone. I went beyond the Bronx and started just going to different communities all over the country that with an initial focus on poverty and drugs, but I started realizing just how immensely divided this country is, hugely divided. And I just, I use that word because I just can't emphasize it enough. And the most salient division beyond race, and race is the first division, but beyond that, the most salient division beyond that is education. It's how we, and you know, if you blindfold me and drop me to any town, I can generally tell you pretty quickly if there's a college there, if it has an elite school. You know, it defines the community, it defines the town. So just, you know, just last month I was in Michigan, and I spent some time in Kalamazoo. Then 35 miles over, I spent some time in Battle Creek, Michigan. Now, Battle Creek, Michigan doesn't have a college, doesn't have a Kalamazoo does. Entirely different towns. Battle Creek voted for Trump. It was the first time that Battle Creek. It was one of those counties that went Obama, Trump. One of the few that did that. And you know, when you spend time in towns that don't where these back row communities versus front row communities, it's not just small things. It's not just, you know, do you have an education? Do you not have an education? It's a very deep sense of how you define yourself and how you value things. It's a worldview, and they're two very different worldviews that are often opposed to each other. And so, it's I always say they speak different languages. A front row kid can't really understand a back row kid, and a back row kid can't really understand a front row kid, and both don't treat each other well. It's not, you know, I write mostly about how the front row picks on the back row, but the back row picks on the front row just as much. It's just a different way of
doing
it.
There's no trust at all there.
No, absolutely none. And we've gotten to a point where we both groups dehumanize the other. The back row looks at the front row and, you know, think them as basically being an American, you know, that in many different ways, that they're not genuine, that they're not true to the American spirit. And then the front row, that's what the back row looks at the front row. And the front row looks at the back row and says, you know, and what's been really depressing this election cycle, as I'm a progressive, I voted for Hillary. I voted actually Bernie, but then Hillary. As a progressive, and I don't like Trump at all, it's been very disappointing to see how the front row behaved towards the back row. They just turned to them in many cases and said, "You're stupid." End of story.
Only an idiot could vote this
yes.
way.
Yes. And that's just, you know, whenever you describe a group's behavior as lacking in some basic human quality rather than a political issue, in my mind, you're doing it wrong, and that's offensive. You shouldn't, you know, you should look at it and say, well, wait, what's really going on here?
The back row feels that, don't they?
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, I mean, completely. They know it. They know they're being made fun of. They know they're just unvalued by the front row. And I go to the front row, back row schoolroom analogy because I think everybody knows that feeling of being kind of in the middle or back or row, and the front row kids looking at you and saying, "You don't get it, do you?" You know, just, you know. but at its core, the meaning, the sense of valuation, the front row defines itself through its intellect, through the rationality, through you know, if you want to be if you want to advance in the front row, you learn how to argue better, you learn how to read more books, you learn how to eviscerate someone through argument. In the back row, it's more about faith, it's more about community, it's more about, you know, have you been here a long time? There's a sociologist by the name of Michel Lamont who wrote about the working class in three countries, France, England, and U.S. I believe it was England. And what she talks about is the back row value, their ethos, how they value themselves is through the decency of hard work. You know, it's I'm just going to work. I'm going to get up every day. I'm not going to make a lot of money, but I'm going to commit myself to doing this. I'm going to do it well. And their ethos, their worldview is the decency of hard work, and the front row is their worldview is an intellect, advancing through intellect. And those two, in many cases, are at polar opposite. Now, there are front row kids who work really hard and value the decency of front work. You know, it's not
sure.
Completely, you know, black and white.
Yeah, and in just a moment, I'll start with Mary Kate on the phone because I know she wants to talk. She's from a rural area and she wants to talk front row, back row definition in 1 second. But think about the framing that Chris is giving us here, and then think about someone in a rural community, a so-called back row kid who values hard work, just wants the opportunity to get up and work, and now perceives the opportunity to do that as gone because of the policies and the choices by the front row kids who think NAFTA is great, TPP is great, and that globalization means suck it up, we're all going to lose our labor jobs eventually anyway, and don't you know that, and get with the times. I mean, then you start to see why the divide is so visceral.
Well, yeah, it is very visceral. And the thing is, often the front row will just simply say, well, move, and which is, you know, that's kind of like the back row saying to you, well, just don't get an education. Give up your books. I mean, you know, it's everything. I mean, their community, where they come from, their family is everything. And that's true of a lot of front row kids, too. But we tend to push that to the side at times when if you have a better career opportunity, you're going to move to London or Turkey or wherever.
So understand by saying, when you say, well, just move, that's asking someone to almost give up their identity.
Exactly, very much.
Who they are. Let me grab that phone call. This is Mary Kate in Rochester, First Step. Go ahead, Mary Kate.
Hi, Evan. Really appreciate your show today and your guest. And I would simply say that, first, just a little bit of background. I grew up in the Southern Tier, moved to Rochester to go to school, and have almost flip-flop careers. So I'm in biotech and actually stopped out for a year. I got my securities license, and that happened to be right before the crash. And I saw products, mortgage-backed security products that scared the life out of me and didn't think they were right, and definitely decided that securities was not a good career choice for me. But I think the reason I'm calling is essentially I don't see the definitions front row, back row kids as clearly as you might define it. I think, you know, growing up in the Southern Tier, there are plenty of folks who actually did support Hillary Clinton, and I'm visiting there a lot because my mother is ill and I'm chipping in and helping to take care of her. But essentially the issues for what I've observed is really about, you know, the issues pertaining to women and civil rights. And so I think it's way beyond the front row, back row issue. I think some of what you're saying makes sense to me, that there is backlash, but I think it's really more about women's rights, civil rights, and inclusiveness and equality. You know, whether or not you firmly take the stance that you know, equality is deserved by all. The folks that are reeling against Trump at the moment, to me, and I did go to the March on Washington, seemed to be talking about the fact that you know, the middle Rust Belt state folks that supported Trump are really being conned by him and essentially are not going to get what he has promised, and that the policies they think are going to help them are actually, we're seeing some evidence of that this week, that essentially the market is starting to slip again, and in long term, he may cause some real damage.
Well, and Mary Kate, let me just jump in and say, first of all, you've given us a lot to talk about. I appreciate the phone call. And I'll let Chris start wherever he wants. I would just say, I think if you read and follow Chris's work, it is more textured than just all back row kids voted for Trump or all rural voters voted for Trump. That's not necessarily the case. I think it's understanding the cultural divides and how we don't humanize one another, and then trying to use that context to understand some people's motivations. So this idea that voters got duped, Chris writes often that these voters were so frustrated that they sent him to Washington to break things. And I'm not even sure they're convinced they're going to get something good out of it. But Chris, how would you respond to what Mary Kate is saying?
A few things. One is, obviously it's not a perfect analogy. You have to look at this election relative to past elections, and where did Trump outperform a generic Republican, and where he outperformed a generic Republican was basically with the people who don't have an education, in counties like Battle Creek and Dubuque, Iowa, Lewiston, Maine, places like that. Those are the places I went. But yeah, it's not a perfect analogy. There's a lot of historical context for why people vote the way they do. You know, the white working class used to vote Democrats. You know, and I can argue about why we no longer do. I think to the thing about whether or not they are going to get what they want. Look, I remember talking to a woman in Battle Creek. I'll just bring her up. She's 82. She and her husband are very much back row kids. They both worked in Battle Creek, if you don't know, is where they make Kellogg cereal. So it smells like Cocoa Puffs, actually. It really does. And
that's kind of nice.
Yeah, it does. It's great. I mean, I just walked around wanting everybody to acknowledge that it was really cool. But
yeah.
People, you know,
they're used to it. Yeah. Yeah, big deal.
Yeah. But they, you know, they've been all their life. They walked right out of high school into factories. They had good lives. They say they had good lives. They had union jobs. And the factories aren't there much anymore. There's about one-fifth the employees who work in the factories that used to. And she said to me, she turned to me, and she actually voted for Hillary. Although I was talking to a group of people like her, similar, all retirees who would work at Post or Kellogg's, she was the sole one who voted for Hillary. The rest voted for Trump. And the rest had all voted Democrats all their life. And she said, look, I'm glad I'm not young. That's a really damning statement for somebody to say. And I said, why? She goes, I don't think my kids are going to have a good life, or my grandkids. You know, we had a great life. We walked right out of high school into a factory. We built things. We had security. We weren't anxious. And she says, my grandkids are just all anxious all the time. And she says, I didn't vote for Trump, but I understand why somebody did, because this just, I don't want to be here anymore. I mean, it's not surprising that the places I found Trump support were the places I had gone to look at addiction, white communities. You know, addiction is a form of checking out, a form of saying, I don't want to be here anymore. And in some senses, I think a lot of Trump voters the big measure of the big difference between the back row and the front row is the back row often looks around and says, and they're right about this, I'm not sure my life is better than my parents' life, and I don't think my kid's life is going to be better than mine. Whereas a front row kid will look and say, you know, my life has been better than my parents' life, and I really think my kid's life is going to be better. It's that outlook trajectory, and that sort of negativity is why the drugs have started entering places like that. It's also why from their perspective, it makes sense to vote for Trump, because in his sense, he just wants to blow things up. And if things aren't working for you, blowing it up is better than nothing. It might work for you, it might not, but you know, I'd rather give it a shot.
This is what Chris.
But I would also just add.
Absolutely.
I would just add that she did say. She says it's really sad. All my friends are voting for Trump, and it's not going to work out for them. I understand why they're doing it, but it's not going to work out for them. And I agree with her. It's not going to work out for them.
But you understand the despair
that
led to it. This is what Chris wrote on Twitter yesterday, and I'm abbreviating one of his long Twitter threads. And if you want to follow him, it's Arnadie, spelled Arnade. Just writing in response to the debate about the immigration ban. This is what Chris writes. Everything Trump has done this week is directed at his base of white back row kids, including wanting the outrage of the front row media. The gap in how both see and value and evaluate and judge things is so large, it effectively means we speak two different dominant languages. The back row sent Trump to break stuff, and the sound of New York City media being outraged is, in their mind, evidence he is doing that. The executive order on immigration, the Muslim ban, did all that. It played into their worldview. Globalism and outsiders are bad, and it outraged the front row. So if you want to evaluate how effective Trump is, or is he succeeding, you have to ask, from which group's perspective? I think those are important points.
But at some point we should talk about the caller also mentioned the racism and the sexism. And, you know, I think that's a very big, you know, I think it plays a factor. I'm not denying that.
Well, on that note, let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to your phone calls, and we're going to pick up right there with Chris Arnotti. If you're just joining us, he's in Rochester because he's on his way to Buffalo, and he's nice enough to stop here. In fact, going to spend some time in Rochester today, later tonight. Will we see any of your work on Twitter here in Rochester?
You'll see me hanging out at McDonald's.
Yeah, and you know what? One of the things I've really learned from Chris is to stop looking down my nose at McDonald's. We're also going to explain that. That's all coming up next. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on The Next Connections. First hour, we're talking about the use of anonymous sources when it comes to the news media. What's appropriate and what is not? What are the standards different publications use? In this age of covering the Trump administration, there are real questions about what the standards should be. Then in our second hour, the Reshaping Rochester series looks to Detroit for some inspiration on how to revitalize. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're going to get to your calls pretty much for the rest of the hour. And it's just going to start with an email here, two emails. And Chris, you've probably heard this. This is from Colin. Colin writes, Chris is a hero to me. I'm a liberal, and he's made me look at rural voters differently. Doesn't mean I always like what I'm hearing, but I'm listening. Here's an email from Janet. Evan, you should point out that Mr. Arnotti is maybe the biggest apologist for Trump voters in this country. He is unable to look people in the eye and say, I'm sorry, but your fears are unfounded and your views are bigoted, end quote. So two very different emails, Chris, and I'm sure you've heard both.
I hear both, yes.
What do you think of Janet saying that what your work does is it's an apology for people who are harboring views, xenophobia, racism, et cetera?
Well, first of all, I did vote for Hillary. But I would say that, look, I'm just trying to give context to help. I don't like Trump. You don't. She doesn't like Trump, I clear. From a sheerly practical standpoint, if your goal is to stop this, and I would like to see it stop, you really need to understand the other side. You understand what motivates them, what their worldview is, and then you can try to figure out how to end it, how to overcome it, how to change it. I'm simply trying to give people an idea of how they view the front row, how they view people like Janet. I don't know if Janet's that. I don't want to
No, I understand.
But how they view that knowledge is simply helpful in my mind for figuring out how. So a perfect example of that. Trump is a master at exposing our differences, that gap, the worldview gap. And he does it to his benefit, and he does it to keep winning. So he creates these false outrages that should be false outrages. Perfect example was when he sent Mike Pence, his VP, to Chili's in Times Square. Now, there is no bigger disagreement. That's one of those examples where the front row and the back row think very differently about things, Chili's, food. By doing that, he got the front row to just start yelling. You know, outrage. How can you go to Chili's? That's an awful restaurant. He's in New York City. He should have went to blah, blah, blah. That only further, it created a sense of community in the back row to bond them further to Trump. Because
that's a trap, beautifully
yeah,
said.
Yeah, beautiful trap. So I always say it's like the New York subway. It's Trump, what he does is he like creates a fake fight between two people. Then he picks your pocket while you're watching the fight. So I'm just trying to give people a roadmap to try to not fall into these traps. You can take it. You can, I'm sorry if some people view it as an apology. it's just in my mind a roadmap.
And these are real human beings, often going through a lot of despair. And Chris is at least showing us who they are. So let's go ahead and grab some more phone calls. Jane in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jane.
This is an excellent program. So many thoughts come to my mind. It's hard to organize them, but it is true from what we all understand that 90% of everything belongs to the top 1%. Now, how can you, anybody could understand why those left out would be enraged, because we get rhetoric that doesn't tell us that. Everything's going to trickle down. The trickle down is still in effect, that idea. We're going to cut taxes and we're going to be great again. But one thing that is so discouraging to me, for example, was when Obama, people were really upset about the banking and could that happen again and so forth. And it was really probably within the last year he was trying to calm nerves, and he was saying, look, you're just not informed. You don't understand. We have Dodd-Frank now, and we have safeguards. This can never happen again. And I thought, does anybody believe that? And I had a choice. Is this person that I have some admiration for lying, or does he really believe what he's saying? In either case, we're in trouble from my point of view. But you're talking about the labor used to go for the Democrats. Well, that's because we don't have Democrats anymore. And I see, like, voted for Hillary, but I see her as another Republican, and she, too, bragged about how great the economy was. And I thought, is she crazy? But And just one more thing, Evan. I feel like the Republicans took up that emptiness there, forgot the void there for the labor movement, those in labor, because they became sort of pseudo-Democrats. If the Democrats aren't going to be Democrats, Trump ran sort of as a Democrat. in my opinion. I mean, I don't think he's going to deliver at all. I think it's going to be a nightmare. And I'm going to say this one last thing because it's so sad. It's so sad, but I believe it. I don't believe younger people have any future unless we get a third or fourth party. Thank you.
Jane, thank you. A lot there, Chris. Go ahead.
I would just say whatever she said. I agree. I completely agree. And I love her accent, by the way. Must be Southern.
Jane is one of our favorites. And I will also say, for the listeners out there, and I know there are progressive listeners who hear Jane say, I view Hillary as another Republican, and they're thinking, no way. Jane's not saying that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are the same. I know there are people who did say that before the election, or some said that they feared Hillary more than Trump, and now I think people are walking back a little bit on that. But on the question of economics, if you want to at least understand why people feel that way, flag, look it up online, look up Matt Stoller's piece, How Democrats Killed Their Populist Soul. Give yourself some time this coming weekend, grab a cup of coffee and read it, and then you'll have a better sense for why people at least feel that way.
I would just simply say, look, I was a banker for 20 years, and as a banker, nobody did me a greater service than Bill Clinton. Bill and Hillary Clinton did more to deregulate and help Wall Street than any politicians.
Lori and Ovid, next up. Go ahead, Lori.
Yes.
Hello. Yes. Go ahead, Lori.
Yes, I actually have a comment and a couple of two questions.
Okay, go ahead.
I really find it fascinating about the front row back row idea, but the thing is, I'm kind of confused because I myself went to college at UC Santa Barbara, and I had kind of a gypsy life. I went to Albany State for 5 years, and then now I live in a back row community. I feel like I'm a chameleon, too. So would I be a back row person or would I be a front row person?
Well, if you're a chameleon, you can change, right? You can see both. Yeah. There's nothing better than being able to see both.
So you can be both.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I certainly feel like, I mean, look, I'm a front row kid who recognizes, I mean, I got a PhD. I was a banker.
Yes.
You know, I'm about as front row as I come. But I feel like I'm aware of the back row. That doesn't mean, you know, I'm aware of what they value, and I try to respect what they value up to a point.
Yeah. And you know, in the back row community that I live in, they were very much for Trump, and I was quite a bit for Hillary. I can't stand Trump. And I even did a thing in our front yard after Halloween. I turned our pumpkin man into Trumpkin. I had a bit of a nice sign on it saying, if you say something three times, it's true, not false, or something like that. And about the wall, I had another picture on this cornrow place, like the cornrow wall against the wall. I'm so against Trump.
I'll ask you a question, though. The people in your community who voted for Trump, do you feel like you get along with them on a personal level?
Oh, actually, somebody on Facebook was very much for Trump, and she actually insulted me personally.
I'm sorry.
Even though I was just like sharing jokes from Saturday Night Live, those videos, and she attacked me personally. It was really
it's amazing
shocking.
what this election has done to people.
Yeah, it's tearing us apart, and it's sad and it's frustrating, and I want to find out what can I do to help get rid of him. I shouldn't say that. That's so bad. I mean, to help, you know, for the next election to change what's going on.
I think, you know,
it's a very
dangerous
situation.
I mean, I'm not a very schooled in policy and local politics, but I think, you know, get involved in the local community politics is just simply the best solution. And try your best to do things as much local and national level. Just be engaged.
On that same subject, Tim in Rochester with a question on bridging that gap. Go ahead, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
I have tried really hard to spend time on sites like Breitbart, talking to my conservative friends, trying to understand the other side, and something that comes through is that a lot of Trump voters genuinely hate liberals. They seem to think all liberals are unemployed or on welfare, and genuinely hate, I don't use that word lightly, liberals. And I don't understand how we can ever have a conversation or bridge that gap when that's how they actually feel about the median liberal.
I mean, I guess my response has always been that social media and engaging, meeting people in person has always, to me, been, look, I'm pretty open when I go in these communities and tell them that I voted for Hillary and that I voted for Bernie. I go to churches and I tell them that I'm not particularly a believer in the Bible. And I myself have never had a problem. I don't, you know, there people make jokes, you know, when I say, well, I vote for Hillary, they'll pray for me, things like that. But I just feel like, I don't know, I've been fortunate in the sense that I think when you meet people and you engage them, and you just without being, and I'm not saying you or anybody else necessarily is this way, without being attacky, and just try to find common ground
in person if you can.
Yeah, in person. I mean, social media is, you know, I say as someone who's has a big social media presence, I should probably, you know, social media is really bad. I mean, you know, it really makes it so hard to have a nuanced, thoughtful discussion. It really encourages people to be divided, and it furthers our divides. And I mean, Trump knows that, and he's using it for that very effect. Again, he's creating chaos because of that.
Yeah, and so Tim, you know, you mentioned going on Breitbart, going in these forums. I would just observe that you're talking about online, and if you listen to the outgoing president, President Obama, I think the one line that will be remembered from his outgoing address was, "Stop arguing with people on the internet and meet them in real life."
Right. I didn't hear that, but I completely agree with that. I mean, you know, the thing is, it took me a long time of spending time and traveling around the United States to really understand the differences. I mean, you know, 6 months, you know, if you had talked to me 3 years ago, even after a year and a half on the road, I would have still been kind of like your last caller.
Interesting. Well, Dave writes to us, and here's a question on whether the front row is going to have to change. Dave says, "Front row versus back row, I feel back row people are tired of front row people forcing their views and mores on the back row." He's right about that, isn't he?
I generally agree with him.
Okay, and so when you say you meet people and your disposition is everyone is the same, I'm not better than you, you're not better than me, we can have a conversation.
In aggregate.
Of course.
I'm better than you.
well, it's just, you know, some front row kids are better than others. But does the front row in this country eventually need to understand that there may have to be at least a shift in respect or an openness to certain changes in values that might lead to different policies or at least the differences in how we treat each other?
I always end talks when I go to community colleges or colleges where I talk to front row kids. I always say, we all talk about know your privilege. That's the big buzzword amongst progressives. I would say education provides you with a lot more privilege than you even know. And recognizing that is the first step to realizing that, you know, you come with a lot more privilege than you know. If you have a, you know, if you have a PhD, if you have a, you know, a graduate degree from most any school, you come with a lot more privilege. Now, there are a lot of front row people who, you know, when I talk about the worst offenders of the front row, I'm not talking about most of your callers at all. I'm not talking about people in Rochester. I'm talking about, you know, I'm talking about people like myself, the bankers in Wall Street, the, you know, high-powered lawyers, the political donor base, you know, the Larry Summers of the world. You know, there's a lot of I like the front row. I'm a member of it. There's a lot of us who are just very, very hardworking, decent people. And, you know, but I think there's a lot more being part of that milieu, being part of that world comes with a lot more privilege than I think you know, and you're a lot more different than you know. You know, just the way you think of things, the way, you know, what you listen to, what you eat, all those things are wrapped with a lot of privilege.
And can I ask about what you eat? There's a lot of temptation for people in the front row, me included, to look down our noses at McDonald's. One of the things that really stands out among your work is that when you travel to these communities where the factories are closed, a lot of the jobs are gone, there's a lot of despair, there are two places where there is a consistent method of support and at least a place to get together and to be together and to talk: churches and McDonald's. And for those who don't believe that about McDonald's, what would you tell them?
Just go to any McDonald's in the morning. There's an old man group. I was just on the one, I think it's on Monroe, before I came here. There's a lot of homeless people who hang out there, who are talking to each other, hanging out, using the Wi-Fi, some addicts. I can spot an addict now. I don't mean to, you know, they go there to sip a coffee, to get a clean bathroom, to be given a little moment of peace and respect and decency. And I didn't want to ever be. I'm a vegetarian. I didn't think I'd ever become a boozer for McDonald's. But
are you still a vegetarian?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I you know, it's very front row of me. And you know, when you spend time with the homeless or addicts, or you start to spend time in the back row communities, you just start spending a lot of time in McDonald's because it's cheap. You know. It's safe. It's got free Wi-Fi. It's got free electricity, and it's got community. And I started looking around me, realizing there's all this community going on. You know, I think, you know, I wrote a piece about it as community centers, and you know, just this young Mexican American couple outside of Houston who were well dressed, and I'm like, why are you? You know, I always talk to people at McDonald's, just go up and start talking to them, and then they asked me to take their picture, and I'm like, you know, why you want me? Oh, we're going to get married. You know, they came to McDonald's before getting married. Other places I've met bingo groups who come and have bingo, church groups who come and you know. But just go to pretty much any McDonald's in the morning. You'll see there's an old man's table as well as old women's table, or retirees get together, chat, talk. And there's also a lot of people who are what the English call living rough, people who are homeless or on the fringes who kind of just spend their days at McDonald's.
Sam in Rochester wants to join the conversation. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. You know, I'm a veteran. I went in the Army in 1968, and, you know, we had the Vietnam conflict, and then you come all the way up from 1968 to what you see in America now, and have someone like Donald Trump in office, who is supposed to be the commander-in-chief, and to see people that follow behind him that says that they would rather see America destroyed than for somebody else to be in charge of it. Now, the president that just left office, he did a fantastic job, because look at the state that the country was in when he took office. And unemployment was outrageous. They were just losing hundreds of thousands of jobs a month. And then he brought that down below 4%. And he gets no credit for that. But to have people say that they would rather see America destroyed like that, and your guess, he kind of hinted to that himself, that you know that he would rather see, because he was agreeing with the lady who made that statement, and I just think that's ridiculous, you know, for somebody to make a statement like that when this country was doing good before Trump took office.
Now, Sam, let me just jump in and say, Chris doesn't say he wants the country to be broken. He's saying there are voters out there who are so despondent that they sent Trump to Washington to break things, and that we shouldn't be surprised that they may celebrate things that we find appalling. But when it comes to, he says, look, the country was doing great. How can this be? Is he missing the communities that are not doing great?
I think if you look at statistics, as I'll be very front row here and look at the statistics. If you don't have an advanced degree, and if you're not a professional, if you work with your hands or your strength, you're not doing well. You haven't been doing well for 25, 30 years. You're just bumping along. You know, 95% of people or 60% of workers are just stagnating and have been stagnating for a long time. And it's even worse at the lower income, especially in minority communities. I was just in Milwaukee. You know, I spent more time on this project. I've spent more time in minority communities than I have in white working class communities, minority working class communities. And the frustration there is off the charts. You go to yeah, Central Cleveland or East Buffalo, where I spent, you know, and I was just in Milwaukee. I was in the black neighborhood, traditional black neighborhood in Milwaukee, and Milwaukee didn't turn out to vote. Now they voted overwhelmingly for the people who voted overwhelmingly for Hillary, but they didn't vote in the numbers that they had voted for.
What do they tell you? And that's everybody tells you something a little different, but generally, what did they tell you?
They're frustrated. There's many different variations of the theme of. Everybody loves Obama in my minority communities, and they should. I voted for Obama twice. I love Obama. But there's a sense of, even after all this, even after 8 years of Obama, we still are facing crime, drugs, stagnating wages.
Joblessness
at twice the rate of white Americans. There's a pent-up frustration, and how it got rendered this election well, it's just less enthusiasm. You know, I heard, and this is shocking for people to say here, for me to say, I heard less anger towards Trump in poor black neighborhoods than I did on college campuses. They didn't, I'm not saying they didn't like him, and I'm not saying there wasn't outrage, but there was a resignation of like, oh, you know, I've seen this for so many times. How like the last caller is like, I can't believe I'm putting up with this. After all this time, I'm still putting up with this. And some of that got rendered as just a, I'm out, I'm done. Now, cynically, the GOP has made it easier for disenfranchised a lot of minorities, but there was a sense of like, I'm out, I'm done. I'm done. This is so frustrating. I don't know what to do anymore.
Down to our last minute. We didn't want to talk too much policy, but I do want to ask you real quick going out the door here. You've been in communities where factories are gone. And again, the front row likes to say that's globalization. That's mechanization. Get with the times. Do you think we have to really think about our values choices and say, are we just giving up when it comes to who creates stuff and where the jobs are?
I completely have changed my 180 degrees. I hate the NAFTA. I hate TARP. I hate TPP. You know, we front row people like to have a policy that we always say we can do anything with enough policy. But we seem to have given up when it comes to creating jobs in back row communities. We just simply say it's just inevitable. That's the only time we've ever said anything is inevitable.
Because front row policies on trade benefit the front row.
Oh, hell yeah. Very much so. And it destroys communities. There's winners and there's losers on free trade. And the winners win more than the losers lose, so we think it's great. But the losers really lose. They lose not just jobs, but they lose their communities.
All right. Chris Arnotti is in Rochester and then on his way to Buffalo and on his way probably across the country again. 100,000 miles on the car in the last 18 months. ARNADE, if you want to follow him on Twitter, where he does a lot of his writing.
I have an underscore in my name, Chris underscore Arnotti.
Just want to thank you for being here and really enjoyed the conversation. Our listeners would have probably talked to you all day, but we'll see you on Twitter.
Thank you.
Chris Arnotti joining us. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, loaded with your feedback both hours. Did as much as we possibly could there. Thanks for all the great interaction today and every day. And thanks for listening to member-supported public radio. We'll talk to you Thursday.